Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, reel number 7. We're talking about the time when the Formidable was undergoing repairs and a bit of a refit as well from the sound of it, at Norfolk, Virginia. That was a negative side of the relationship with the Yanks. But you seem to. What about the civilians? Because you seem to have got on well with some of them, at least.
Oh, yes. I mean, lots of them sort of met families, that sort of thing. It seemed that the services, they had this thing they had to sort of be fighting it.
What about the civilians? How did you get on with them?
Oh, very well. I mean, got around. I mean, we used to go to Virginia Beach, catch a bus out of Virginia Beach, and there was a big funfair there, you know, sort of all the rides. I met a couple of girls with sisters, and we used to go out to their house. Their father was in the Navy, he was away. Met their mother, we sometimes visit them in their house. We got on well. While we were there, we got some leave. My mate was a Taffy, and he had relations in Wilkes-Barre in Pennsylvania. So we decided we'd go up to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, to visit. And Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, the coal mining area. And more or less it was divided into four. There was the Scots, the English, the Welsh and the Irish all living in Pennsylvania and sort of had their own sort of little community. And my friend, he had an elderly aunt and uncle. They were in their 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And a cousin who I suppose was about 50. He worked for the local council. And because he happened to tell the mayor that we were visiting and it was announced over the local radio we were there. And they wanted to make us welcome, everybody to do their best for us, etc., etc. He invited us to the town hall and they just had a new police radio set up there. Knowing that we were radio operators, he showed us all around his new police radio set up. And then at that time, the Americans were building a new cruiser, going to be named Wilkes-Barre after the town. So he showed us all the photos of the building of this. We got invited to by a director of the local brewery, and I always remember this. My mate's old uncle, I think was in his early 80s, we went to this brewery, shown all around the brewery. Then we go into the bar, we're drinking merrily, piled us high with cans of beer, and we went back home with me and my mate and his uncle between us holding our arms. He kept kicking his legs in the air and he was absolutely tight. And I thought, oh dear, we're going to get into trouble with, you know, his aunt. Anyway, we got there, she said, oh, look at him, she said, yeah, he's had a good time. And she got her hands on his backside and pushed him upstairs, took him to bed, like you see. While we were there, a couple of friends of theirs, they got introduced to us. And as I say, we got stopped by people in the street, shake our hands. And when we went in a bar, you know, they'd come over and talk to you and that sort of thing. And while we were there, I mentioned that I had relatives who lived in Long Island in New York. And because their surname was Earl, as I mentioned earlier on, sort of my mother's maiden name. They said, oh, we'll ring up, we'll get in touch, find them. And anyway, they got in touch with my relatives and arranged to take us both up there to meet them. So I met my aunt outside the big cathedral in New York. I think it's St. David's, I think it is, I'm not sure. St. Peter's or St. David's, big cathedral in New York. Because my aunt did a lot of work. She used to do a lot of sewing for, you know, the choirs, cassocks and surplices, that sort of thing. And they wanted me to stop for a while, so my mate went back with these two friends to Wilkes-Barre. And I went home with my aunt. Now I've got my Uncle Will, my Aunt Connie, Cousin Bob and Cousin Cynthia. Cynthia was a concert pianist. She used to play with all the, you know, the big orchestras and that sort of thing. And Bob, I don't know what he did. I think he was a mechanic or something. Anyway, I had a marvellous time there because Cynthia mixed with a lot of moneyed people. So one day she was going horse riding with some New York surgeon or something. She used to go every week. So they took me and said, can you put him on a horse? And he's never been on a horse before. And the funny thing was, isn't he in a sailor's suit? And I remember they put me on this horse, and this Negro groom was adjusting the stirrups, and he said, boy, he said, you sure has got long legs. And I went out with one of their trainers, and quite funny, seems Jolly Jack set this rider horse going through the countryside in Nevada. Another time I went to yachting with one of her friends in Oyster Bay, and a nice yacht. So I had a wonderful time, really. She could never get over my cousin. She'd say, you're so happy and so sort of contented, yet your country's at war. I said, well, of course I am. I said, they're all going through hell over there, and I'm having the time of my life here, which I was at the time, is it? Anyway, because I hadn't got any spare clothes with me, I was wearing my cousin's pyjamas. When, you know, they rearranged the bedding arrangement and wore my cousin's pyjamas and some underwear. And because my sailor's white front, I only had the one. So I remember my cousin saying to me, well, I've seen sailors, I've got a jumper like that, she said, with blue and white stripes on it. So I said, well, not English sailors, you have it. So anyway, while my aunt was washing my white front, I went out one day with this blue and white stripe thing, looking like a Polish sailor, but no one knew any difference. I went bowling at Skitladdies up there with my cousin's friends. He used to just go out with them, and I went to roller skating. You know, and there's one lady there, quite a wealthy widow. She said to my aunt, she says, oh, you know, want to take him out to a meal? My aunt took me along. We went to the Biltmore Hotel and had a big meal there. Yeah, they were really good, yeah.
So it's just the sailors, the sailors in the army you trouble with.
But then there's a funny thing. They drove me back to Wilkes-Barre. I remember Bob had this beautiful red Ford sports car. He was a car man. In fact, he lives now in up in Washington State, a place called Bellingham. And I mean, he's well in his 80s, and he's still got an old vintage car there, beautiful old car. But he was always a car man. But he had this beautiful red sports car, and they drove me back to Wilkes-Barre. Well, then,
sounds like quite a long leave.
Yeah, a bit later. I got another leave, and I went up by train. Now, on this journey, so we talk about the fighting, I would go up by train, and it was loaded with American soldiers going on leave. They got talking to me, you see, and said, what are you doing over here, and that sort of thing. And when I mentioned that we'd been bombed at Crete and that sort of thing, the typical American, he yelled out to everybody in the carriage, hey, guys, he said, this guy has seen action. Like, see, and with that, all these soldiers come charging. And because I'd got my photograph album then, I was going to take up to show my aunt and family, you see, because I was going, and because it showed the, you know, the bombing and all that sort of thing in the snapshots. And when we got to a central station in New York, I remember there was my aunt and my two cousins spread out along the platform to, you know, to see where I was. And these soldiers carried me shoulder high off the train, you know, and they were all, and walking me down the platform, and I was waving to my family, like, see, and they said, what's going on? I said, well, they reckon I'm a hero. But, you know, this typical American, he's seen action, like, see. But, you know, I after that, I used to think they were full of bull. But then you found out they were exactly the same amongst themselves. It wasn't put on for us at all. It was their way, you know, sort of, you know, you're a veteran and you've seen action and all this sort of thing. You know, it's an American way.
Now, did you have many duties aboard ship when you were aboard? I mean, you know, or was it pretty, while it was being refitted?
Well, you know, basically cleaning stations, instructions on the equipment all the time, that sort of thing.
Any new equipment?
Not as far as radio is concerned. I say they put 30 Oerlikons. We were hoping to get a load of aircraft.
Because now, were you still a boy at the time? Or
I've been made an ordinary telegraphist by this time. I was an ordinary telegraphist.
Now, did the men's mess, if you like, you know, the normal mess, did that differ much from the boys' mess?
No, I mean, you had a leading hand in charge of each mess, like, you know, each table, so you had a leading hand in charge of each mess. It was one of you, you know, it was one of your mates, that sort of thing. But, I mean, he made sure you kept in line, and, you know, it was sort of, didn't leave any stuff lying around, you know.
Was it the same layout, you know?
Just the same, no different.
No more room or less room.
One of the other things you had on the carrier too was a cinema, which was handy.
Tell us about that. What sort of cinema show?
You used to go into the lift well, and they used to lower the lift. So you used to sit in the lift, and because it was all over the top, they lower a screen one end, and the projector room was behind the back of the lift. So you used to,
so this is the aircraft lift.
The aircraft lift. Yes.
And what sort of show would they put on? What was popular? What wasn't popular?
They used to, when you're with a fleet, they used to swap films. There was always, the entertainment office was always sort of checking what films they had. But I always remember these cartoons, Fred Quimby. You remember? I always see his name. Well, as soon as it came on, all the map load, "Good old Fred!" Like, as soon as Fred Quimby came up, as soon as his name came up, "Good old Fred!" And because the other thing he used to do, he used to go to the Naffy and get what we used to call goffers. And it was a fruit drink. I mean, it was like blackcurrant crystals put in water or orange crystals put in water. And you used to get a big fanny full of, you'd go out and fill it up, and then you'd sit there in the cinema with your big fanny full of goffers, drinking goffers with your mates, don't you?
And so they had the cartoons. That sounds like Tom and Jerry and things. Fred,
oh, that's right. Yeah, Fred Quimby.
What sort of film would it be? Just the feature films of the day. I mean,
and they used to swap around at different ships. If you got any films, or whenever they went into harbour anywhere, the first thing they do was get in touch with the shore and say, we've got some films to swap to you. So
they would they have instructional films as well? Serious films.
No, I don't.
It was just
fun film, really. And of course, you had a. On the carrier too, which you don't have on the, I suppose you have them on the capital ships, a big canteen area, where you could sit. And I mean, the floor was marked out. You used to play uckers, as they call it, uckers, sort of. They have a piano in there, because you always had someone who could play a piano, so you'd have sing songs.
Was uckers really popular? I mean, it's not very popular. I mean, these days it's Ludo, isn't it?
Yeah, Ludo. That's all it is. Your uckers, because you play big board uckers. One thing I did notice, I used to get into it. A lot of the old sailors used to play the mahjong.
What's that?
The Chinese game, with the dice and mahjong, and because the sailors, when you see them later, when I went to Hong Kong later in my naval career. Usually the Chinese playing and banging them things down. The sailors used to have words, their own words for them, like soap, taxi, thing with four like wheels on it was called taxi. Another one, a little bomb, was called soap. They had their own. And it used to fascinate me watching these old sailors playing the mahjong.
Was there much gambling? Legal or illegal? You know what I mean.
I suppose some of them did gamble. My crown and anchor, I suppose, was the thing. But you didn't see much of it around on the mess.
You didn't do any.
No, never interested in me ever gambling.
So how long were you there? I mean, do you know when you left or what happened next?
We was there a few months. Well, we went down, once we were ready for sea, we went down to Newport News. And we were tied up alongside the jetty. And this is the interesting thing. We had an American aircraft out over the Atlantic flying up and down. So they were calibrating our radar. Pearl Harbor happened.
This is December then, 1941.
December the 7th, 1941. Pearl Harbor happened. This American media came up and said, "Ceasing exercise, got to go back to base, I'm not armed." Now, he's in the Atlantic. You've got about 3,000 miles across the States, about another 5,000 miles to Hawaii, and this boy's scared because he's in an aircraft over the Atlantic and he hasn't got any arm. He's not armed. And he packed up the exercise. And we sailed back home then for Christmas.
And whereabouts home? Anything about that running across the Atlantic?
Yeah, I can't remember. Where did we go? I got a feeling we went into Greenock. I'm not sure. But I know we went to Greenock a couple of times at different times, but
What happened when he got it there? Did he see it
either green or rust, I can't remember. I've been perfectly honest, I just can't remember. We had Christmas leave. And after Christmas leave, of course, the Japs having come in the war, obviously the government was worried about the Japs coming across, you know, India, Africa. So they were going to form a quick fleet to go out. So we were one of them. We took the admiral out. I can't remember the admiral's name now, but we took the admiral out. And the thing that stands in my mind was that at one stage going out to the Far East, we went to Mombasa first.
You were going to be the Far East Fleet?
Yeah. Well, it was called a Far East Fleet then, I think, because later they had the British Pacific Fleet. But we were virtually operating from Mombasa across to Colombo and then a bit east of Colombo into the Pacific Ocean, just on patrol. But when he took us out there, he cleared lower deck and he said one lesson he'd learned, that he would not split his force, and because they'd gathered ships from all around the world to form a fleet. And I remember two things stick out in my mind when we were doing these patrols. Being a DF operator, one day I was on watch there, and the most powerful signal you could ever hear, so it must have been very, very close and a very, very powerful transmitter. You get the whole, when you get a signal like that, which is so powerful, so close, it seems the whole air is oscillating with the signal. Yeah. And this was very, very powerful, and the station was using the call sign of Esquimalt in Canada, which is a big Canadian airstrip. I took a DF bearing of this. There was nowhere in any way Esquimalt in Canada, and then it was too far away for the strength of the signal. And on retrospect, you know, it was obvious now, when the war's over, you see all these reports. It was some supply ships supplying U-boats, I reckon. I reported this and nothing was done about it. And that always upset me, because it couldn't have been more than 50 miles away at the most. And we had aircraft on board. All they had to do was fly an aircraft off in that direction. And the admiral, when cleared lower deck, he said that he wouldn't split his force. We were at anchor in Colombo Harbour, one of the piers we were there. And there was a report that there was a Jap force at sea. So we immediately put to sea and went out towards the east into the Pacific. And we had the Hermes, an old carrier, with us as well. We're familiar with us, the new carrier. Hermes, an old carrier. She couldn't keep up because, yeah, we were going too fast. So the admiral sent the Hermes back to Colombo. He told the two county-class cruisers, the Daughters from Cornwall, to escort her back. Next morning, we're steaming off the Maldives, and a destroyer in the destroyer screen reported Kali rafts and lifeboats on the beaches. Sent them over to investigate, and that was all that was left of the Hermes, the Daughters from Cornwall. The Japs have, you know, got them. And we had a...
So he had split his force?
He split his force. One thing he said he wouldn't do, the first time he did it, we lost three capital ships. They spread the survivors around amongst the ships. What I thought was a bit foolish at the time, we had a signalman come on board us who came off the carrier, and I thought, well, the last place to put him was on another carrier if he'd just been bombed. And he told me that action station sounded, he was running through the hangar to his action station, the next thing he was swimming in the water. So he was blown apart. They reckon there was about 50 dive bombers dived on him from this Jap force. We never saw the force in the main, but they reckon there was more than one force out. Those two things stuck in my mind. One, that I didn't take any notice of my report of this. I don't know whether it's because I was a young ordinary teller or what, but when after the war and you read all these reports about all these ships supplying U-boats all over the place.
Now, what was life like based at Colombo and Mombasa? That's where you'd stay?
Yeah, they would stay. Mombasa was just a little shanty town. Quite nice, but it was only a little shanty. There was nothing there, really. One of the interesting things, the first lieutenant, or the executive officer on the ship, asked for volunteers to take some of the sea boats up a river or bay off the main harbour there. It was like a banyan picnic, but you had to clean the boats. I volunteered to go, and you just rowed them up the river and beached them, got the old canvas and sand and cleaned them all up, and then we lit a fire and had a bit of a banyan and wandered around the jungle a bit. Quite interesting. Colombo was a nice place, very interesting. Remember, we used to go in a bar there. It was in a private house, and it was a bit dingy. The reason we used to go in there, we used to go upstairs, and there was no carpets on the stairs. It was like a little terrace type house, and sit there, and there was obviously just a few people, but there was a young Singhalese who used to play a violin, and absolutely beautiful. We used to sit there listening for ages. It was absolutely beautiful. The one thing I got out there was dysentery. There was a lot of illness amongst the ships out there.
And how badly did you get it?
I mean, bad. Used to go and watch in the main wireless office, and you couldn't be relieved. And I remember sitting there on watch, and used to tip the chair over, because there were these tubular steel chairs, and stick the corner of the chair up your backside because you couldn't hold yourself, to sit there while you're on watch. And the bloke was relieving you, he was sat in the heads, asleep, just running out of him. And then you used to get relieved on watch, and you'd go up there and you'd sit on the toilet, and you'd sleep on the toilet with it just run out. And I remember I was going to go on watch to the coming off watch up on the island. I'd been in the remote control office, and the ship was steaming. I'm not going all that fast, and there was this gentle breeze going across the flight deck from the actual way of the ship, and that threw me on my back. I couldn't stand up. I had to crawl across. So weak, I had to crawl across.
Was there any treatment? I mean, did they give you anything?
No. I suffered with hemorrhoids ever since. And funny enough, I went to a naval reunion, and one of the other ships I was on, and I hadn't seen these chaps for 40 years, and the first thing these two lads said was, "How's the pirates, chief?" So the only thing they remembered about me.
And that was caused by the dysentery, really.
Yeah, I remember. And I'm just holding, sort of strain yourself, really. But there was a lot of disease on some of the ships, worse than that, sort of other disease. It was just a bad place to be, really.
Anything else you remember about your time out there?
No, not really. It's, as they say, war is 90% boredom and 10% accident, don't they? Just patrolling back and forth, doing your watches and routine, that sort of thing.
Had anything changed, or were you just the same jobs?
Mainly the same job, probably. Yeah, mainly the same jobs.
Nothing new?
Well, the one thing that happened was we had one of our coders on board was an ex-school teacher, and he suddenly got relieved off watch and taken down the captain's cabin, and he was down there all day every day, and he was sworn to secrecy, and we were never told what it was all about, and we couldn't get it out of him. And anyway, when we left the Far East, we came back home, and if I remember rightly, we did one Russian convoy, we went up as far as Bear Island. I'm not sure whether that was after the American trip before we went out the Far East, or I think it was after the Far East, because I remember, yes, that's right, we went into Greenock, and it was winter and it was cold.
So when did you get back to England?
Oh, I can't remember exactly. I know.
Were you out a year in the Far East then?
I wouldn't say a complete year, no.
So still in 42?
It was middle of 40, it was coming up to that. I think we escorted one Russian convoy as far as Bear Island, and we turned back, the others carried on. And the reason then we sailed...
Well, what was that like, the Russian convoy? Well, partly the Bear Island thing.
It was quite uneventful when we were on, someone would work terrific, but I mean, we left at Bear Island, and you know, they must have got the worst half of that. But I can't remember.
And where were you based, Scapa or?
No, we sailed from Greenock on that. Just we came back, as I say, because I remember it's quite cold when we was in Greenock. But I could be getting mixed up at the times because we went into Greenock a couple of times and Rosyth once. I can't remember which side we were. And then we sailed for Operation Torch, the North African landings, and that was why this coda was away. We found out then he was an expert model maker, and we were covering the Algiers section of the African landings, and our aircraft, there was outside of Algiers, there was a French Foreign Legion fort, and what he was doing was making a model of the terrain all around Algiers, large model for the Fleet Air Arm pilots to study. That's the first we knew about it after it had happened. So we would be called back to go for the North African landings. And I say we were on the section covering the Algiers side first. Then after everybody was landed and the war was going on.
Now, what do you remember of the landing and things? I mean, was there anything that involved you in the Formidable particularly, or were you just a covering force?
Just our aircraft were doing the bombing. I mean, with the normal, you know, from our point of view, just bring the radio and doing your normal job, you know. After the actual landings, the fleet used to patrol between Oran and Algiers, go up and down. Now, it was during this time that, and we used to go into Oran, or Mers El Kiba, which was the naval base alongside Mers, and that was where HMS Hood and its force sunk the French fleet in Mers El Kiba.
Ages before,
because that was the sort of the naval base. Couple of attempts at frogman attacks on us in Mers El Kiba. They used to drop charges over the side, that sort of thing. During this time, I did my bravest feat of the war.
Tell us about that.
I disobeyed the Commander-in-Chief.
How come? Tell us the whole story.
We were steaming up and down off the North African coast, and I was in the remote control office, which is, I say, where you do the manoeuvring from. And at this time, I was on the operator on the bay. There's one coda which they call the, because when you're operating, manoeuvring, that sort of thing, they're not security codes, they're brevity codes, you know, sort of little codes, fleet code and things like that, which the coda would decode. And one leading hand of the watch, I remember leading hand of the watch, a chap called Richardson, the leading to leg of his Richards.
And you were on the which radio?
I was remote control. There's no radios out there. You just have the Morse key, microphone, and a little control unit. A chap in the main wireless office, he keeps a receiver tuned in.
And this is a remote control for steering the fleet or the ship?
For doing manoeuvres and all that sort of thing. And in those days, you didn't have VHF or UHF radios, so you used to manoeuvre the ships on MF waves. But the orders were to keep the volume, the power turned right down, so that, hopefully it wouldn't radiate too far. Though that doesn't always follow.